Hey, Mormon Stories listeners, just a couple of quick announcements. First, please mark your calendars for the two upcoming Mormon Stories regional conferences. The Salt Lake City Conference will be held the weekend of June 10th, 2011, and the San Diego Conference will be held the weekend of July 22nd, 2011. Please join our Mormon Stories Facebook group to learn more about these conferences. Next, if any of you are interested in locating other Mormons like you amongst your family, friends, etc., or in your local community, please friend me, John DeLynn, on Facebook. And also, more importantly, visit the Support Communities section of MormonStories.org to locate the Mormon Stories Facebook support group in your city. Currently, we have over 40 support groups worldwide and are hoping to create many more. Finally, Mormon Stories is made possible by listeners like you. To keep it alive, along with all these other services, please become a monthly subscriber today at MormonStories.org. Thank you very much.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Mormon Stories. This is Natasha Helfer Parker, and today I am planning on broaching the diverse topic of race, specifically what it's like to grow up in the church as a black member. With me tonight, I have Dustin Jones. He's a lifelong member of the church, husband, father of four, lawyer, practicing law, and residing in Arizona. Hello, Dustin.
Good evening. How are you?
Good. So, thank you so much for joining me tonight.
I'm honored. I know there are a few of us, but I am honored.
Oh. You're so kind. Okay. So, so I would like to get started with your basic background and kind of just start with the beginning as far as your, you know, where you come from, and tell me your story.
Okay. Very good. Let me see. What I want to do is at least let your listeners realize and pay homage, I should say, to my Mormon heritage, my pioneer Mormon heritage that goes back to 1830 when my ancestors were converted to the gospel. Whenever I say that, whenever I've given a talk, people always kind of look at me and kind of squint. Really, your ancestors were converted in 1830? You're one of the descendants of the black Mormons that came across the plains? And I have to clarify. No, that's not actually the case. I'm biracial. My mother is white and my dad is black. So on my mother's side of the family, I have very strong and deep Mormon pioneer stock roots that I'm very, very proud of. My grandmother, bless her heart, was very much a genealogist. And so she was very proud of our Mormon heritage. She would always tell us the stories of our direct ancestry and direct lineage in the church, all the way back to Levi Ward Hancock. He was baptized in 1830 and was a friend of the Prophet Joseph Smith.
Wow.
Participated in all of the events of the Restoration, the principal events, participated in Zion's Camp, participated in the Mormon Battalion, was in Kirtland, was in Nauvoo, was very loyal to the Prophet, and kept a journal. A lot of our Mormon history that we have that you can research at BYU or at the University of Utah, a lot of it is derived from his journal and his son's journal. To give you an idea of how much he loved Mormonism and loved Joseph Smith, his son from his first wife, from Levi's first wife, he named Mosiah. And you obviously know where he got the name Mosiah, but Mosiah Hancock was his first son. One of his last son with his first wife, from whom I'm a direct descendant, was Joseph Smith Hancock. Again, showing kind of his allegiance, his love for Joseph Smith. I have a copy of his journal that I think it's just reproduced, typed transcripts of the journal that my grandmother passed down to me. I read these as a kid. I've read them recently. I've used them in talks as I've served in leadership of the church. I served probably almost 10 years as a stake young men's president and taught institute and seminary. More recently.
You're standing in front of this congregation as a Black man talking about your pioneer heritage and even, it sounds like, polygamy roots.
And I love blowing everybody's brain cells.
I love to start talking about it, and
before I kind of disclose kind of the names of people, I start to kind of get the look and the tilt of the head. Really? Wow. Fascinating. But yeah, I definitely from a part of me is very much Mormon stock. Again, being raised, and my grandmother being a genealogist and being very, very proud member of the Utah, Daughters of the Utah Pioneers, and knowing her history, again, from Levi Ward Hancock and Mosiah, Joseph Smith Hancock, they settled in northern Arizona, which is where my family's from, in Taylor, Arizona, is where my grandmother was born. My mother was born up in northern Arizona, I believe, in Winslow. My great-grandparents are all are buried up there. That's where our roots are. I used to go as a kid to the Hancock reunions up in northern Arizona. It was always kind of funny in those situations where we'd show up at the reunion and it'd just be this, you know, we'd be at a park and there'd be all these kids and all these white kids running around the family. And my grandma would be very, very proud at this point to show up with her grandkids. And we'd always just kind of look around because there was no question we were the quote-unquote black sheep of the family. I mean, there's no pun intended. And people were just kind of looking and kind of looking around like, who are these kids?
Wow.
Siblings. But I'm sure that, I mean, we didn't sense anything hostile or anything like that, but it was just unique because it was a family reunion and people are going, okay, how are these kids part of the family?
I wonder how unique your position is. I wonder how many biracial, you know, members, like, I mean, I guess, you know, in the last probably 20, 30 years, there's been more, you know, likelihood of there being biracial children, but that sounds like a pretty unique position.
Yeah, my grandmother, she did a very good job of instilling us that pride of the Mormon heritage, and I love her for that. I mean, she was very instrumental in helping me develop my testimony of the gospel. She was very much one that studied things and would try to pass those on to me. I was her eldest grandchild, and she loved to impart kind of our Mormon heritage and talk about Hancock and how we were related to John Hancock, who was a signatory of the Declaration of Independence. She just really got into that, and so I've always
like
had
American history.
Yes, American history, the Mormon history. She had all the genealogy back to England and all of that. I mean, it was just really part of my sense of heritage and place within Mormon history, Mormon culture, and feeling very much a part of it. This one side of me. The other side is my African American side of the family, and my biological family, father. My biological family comes from Mississippi, and they moved to northern Arizona, to Winslow, Arizona, to work on the trains, on the railroads up there many years ago. I believe it was in the 40s, because my father was, I believe, or moved there in the 50s or 40s. But they've been up in northern Arizona, and they're still there. There's a small African American community in Winslow, Arizona, interestingly. On the other side of the tracks, of course, because you go up there and it's very clear there's that side of the tracks and there's the rest of the town, and that's where they live. They've been there for many, many years. Speak about my mom, give you a little bit of history about my mom. My mom in the 60s was probably much more of a product of her time in the 60s as things were changing socially and things like that. She liked black guys. I'll just be very, very clear. I don't know if there were a lot of them in Winslow, but she loved music. She loved to dance. She loved to go out. And that was the crowd that she was hanging with. Mm-hmm. And so that's where
hippie,
I
hippie per se.
She was the hippie, kind of the probably the free love.
Right,
and all.
Right.
But just a very happy person, loved life, raised me to love life.
Oldest in her family?
She was, okay. She was my grandmother's oldest child. And so that's just kind of how her outlook on life. Very positive, very fun loving. I have so many fun stories, neighbors and kids that knew my mom as a kid. She was more like kind of like a big sister than your mom. She was never the authoritarian mom figure. She was the big sister, and we could talk about anything. She was very open about anything. She never, you know, she was one of those that didn't raise me believe in Santa Claus, because that's not true, and I'm not going to tell you something that's not true. And she told it to me as a myth, as a cute story to believe in, but the truth was more important to her than to tell me something that was not true.
I'm assuming that this kind of free love, liking black men. I'm assuming that didn't go over very well with her parents, or
it did not. When I was, and I learned about this more as I got older. When I was 14 years old, I was kind of perusing her collection of books on her shelf, and I pulled out The Miracle of Forgiveness by Spencer W. Kimball, and out fell a birth certificate. I remember looking at this birth certificate, and it said Baby Boy Jones, and it had a different date, had a date of 1970, and I knew I was born in 72, and I'm looking at this birth certificate, and I'm just with the, just bewilderment, kind of puzzled, wondering, okay, am I actually 2 years older than my mom has told me? And I thought, wow, that's cool, I can drive now, I'm 16. and I started thinking about it, and I'm like, okay, who, why would this is a different date, it's my mom's name on there, it's clear, it was official, it was definitely a birth certificate. So I said, Mom, what is this birth certificate for this baby boy? And her eyes, I mean, I could see the emotion in her eyes, and she said, give me that, and she took it away from me. And she said, I'll talk to you about this some other time in your life. And it sat there for probably another 4 or 5 years. Just as I was leaving on my mission at 19, she wanted to talk to me about some of these things. And now that I was kind of going into adulthood, I'd already spent a year at the University of Arizona. And she let me know that she had had a child before me, 2 years before. She had gotten pregnant.
Wow.
By a black man as well in 1970. And that because of the circumstances, that she had to give this child up for adoption to the state of Nevada. She went to Las Vegas to bear the child. And he was given away in Nevada. And so,
how old was she? Why did she have
She was 18.
Okay.
She just turned 18 when this happened.
So she was a legal adult, but...
Yeah, but probably the family circumstances and whatnot, mm-hmm. that was what she felt compelled to do mm-hmm. at the time. And this was, again, this is prior to the priesthood ban. This is a Mormon family. This is a Mormon community.
Right.
I can't imagine that there were too many allies of hers, and this was probably the best way to deal with it. I don't know if she was whisked away to Vegas to deliver, or with people in the community knew about it. I don't know what happened then. I do know from talking to my biological father that he told me that my mom just essentially kind of disappeared. You know, she just was gone. She didn't know where she went, and she came back to town, back to Winslow, and she was like, "Oh yeah, I've been in Vegas." And he didn't know what she was off in Vegas for. She initially didn't tell him. They started dating. She got pregnant with me, and it was again kind of a touchy situation in the community for her and for my father.
So are you saying that she left your town before she would show that she was even pregnant? Like nobody really knew she was pregnant, and so she was gone for, let's say, 5 months while she was giving birth to the baby? Is that kind of what you're assuming?
That was the impression I got, because my father, my biological father, knew her, they had mutual friends, but he just said, your mom just disappear. I mean, she was just gone, and we didn't know what happened to her, where she went. We just were told that she moved, and then she came back all of a sudden. And I never really talked to my grandmother about how many people in the community in Winslow knew that my mom had this child before.
Okay. So even at the age of 14, when you broach the subject to her with this birth certificate, it's still very hush-hush. I mean, 14 years later, she's definitely still in a position where this is very painful. This is not talked about.
Yes, absolutely. And even I didn't talk to my grandmother. My grandmother, no one ever talked to me about it, and no one talked to me about it until I had returned back from a mission. So I was 21 when I was having adult grown-up conversations, I should say, with my grandmother about this situation. They were all like, well, yeah, we didn't know if you should tell you or how, and that was your mom's thing to tell you, and I respect that. Right. But she kind of, at that point, me as an adult, kind of opened up and told me more of the story of what had happened and things like
that.
It's
an interesting book to find that birth certificate in.
Yeah, and I asked about that, and I think that was part of, she was given that, I was part of her repentance process. She was counseled to go through as she had had premarital sex and things like that. I don't know why that was where that book was at. But
so as far as your mom is concerned, you know, the way you're depicting her is kind of this fun-loving and exploring life and, you know, having premarital relationships. And what was her relationship with the church at that point? Was she kind of just still a believing member of the church, just not living by its precepts? Or was she just saying, you know what, I'm just not really buying the story, and so I'm just going to kind of go live my own life?
No, she's a believing member, just not living the standards, just her personal choices. I mean, my mom has never, ever doubted the truthfulness of the gospel, the church. She struggled with living the standards herself at times, but she never, ever questions. I never, ever heard her question or doubt a leader, a general authority, anything she ever was taught by anyone in the church. I mean, that just was just something that never happened.
Okay. And that's true to this day as far as...
True to this day as well, okay. Yeah. I was visiting with her just last week, and she still has that still affirmation of truth about everything and what's the truthfulness of the church and the restoration. Absolutely.
So do you have a sense from your mom's perspective? I mean, here we have, you know, some quotes from Brigham Young from back in the day that, you know, people who would have children interracially, that those children would die on the spot. Or, I mean, obviously that didn't happen, but there's a lot of, I guess, background for her to feel dismissed somehow or feel guilty. Or has she ever talked about what that was like to have that kind of, I don't know, that kind of doctrinal background of her religion, and then yet mixing her race with somebody else? Has she ever talked about that?
I got more of the doctrinal teaching side of things from my grandmother, who struggled more with it than probably my mom did. My grandmother struggled a lot with my eldest brother, who was placed in adoption. I mean, it was just a lot of heartache. There was just a lot of heartache accepting that this pioneer heritage, this Mormon pioneer stock, and all the things that had been said by all the general authorities about not mixing the races and things like that, that her daughter had done this, and that she literally, her posterity, there was, in her mind, there was little hope. From an eternal perspective, from a salvation perspective, there was just too many unknowns and too many things that had been said by leaders of the church that were of concern to her when I was born and when my eldest brother was born. It was just really weighing on her. She had in her possession a book entitled "The Church and the Negro" that was published in 1967. That I don't know if you can find this. I've tried to Google it and look for it, and I don't know that you can find it anywhere. But it was written by a John Lewis Lund, who was a CES veteran. I mean, he attempts to explain the priesthood ban, interracial marriage, all these types of things, the curse, Cain. Well, we can talk about some of these things later. But all of this was kind of in this book, and summarized here and explain it. She had this. This was given to her. I got it before I went on my mission. She'd given it to me as a teenager to read. I'd read these things. So she had all this in her mind when I was young, and it was very troubling to her. This print, this copy I have is a 1972 copy, 72-year copy, right when the year I was born. And so she struggled with that. And I remember sitting down with her before I went on my mission and her talking to me about her feelings at the time, and it was almost as though she was wanting to apologize to me for the way she felt about me when I was born. Was the sense I got, and she was pretty clear. She was very emotional about how the sense of despair she felt, knowing that she was going to have a black grandchild, was very, very disturbing to her. My grandfather, who was not a member of the church, actually, he essentially wrote my mom off at this point.
Your grandmother's husband?
This is my grandmother's husband, my mom's father.
He was not a member of the church.
He was not a member of the church. So it was already kind of a mixed family there. But they were married, and he was married to my grandmother. But he was from old Oklahoma family, and they also believe you just did not mix the races. It was just something you just did not do. And I can tell you, I had no contact with him almost my entire life until 10 years ago. It was when he thought he was going to die, and he had gotten cancer. And it was at that point when he, 70 years old, realized that he should reach out to his posterity. He didn't have any. My mom was his only child. We were his only grandchildren, his only descendants. And he had moved to Phoenix, and I was practicing law at this time, and he wanted to come and meet me. And so that's when I met my biological grandfather, my mom's dad, for the first time just 10 years ago. And he also was very
amazing
and very apologetic. And he apologized that, yes, he had disowned my mom. And he just wanted me to understand. He said, "Dustin, I just want you to understand." He says, "Just the world that I came from, the world I grew up in, even in Winslow, you just did not mix the races. And it just was something I could not comprehend why my daughter had done this. It was something I could not accept. And yes, I was a racist. I'm probably still a racist, but that's just how we saw the world back then, Dustin. It just, there was just nothing else to think of. And so I just didn't have any idea how to react to your mother." And then he talked to me about that, and he mentioned that and he still goes back up to Winslow, which is where he worked on the railroad for many, many years. And he said, "You know, you and I can visit down here, Dustin. I can get together with you for lunch and go see your kids. I'm gonna meet my great grandkids and things like that. But we can never be seen together in Winslow."
Oh my god!
Really? And he said, "I that's just not something I can have my friends know, that I have a black grandson."
Oh,
and I just thought, okay, so it's still alive and well.
So is he still alive?
He's still alive, uh-huh. and we have a good relationship. And I think him being exposed to me and my family, my wife and my kids. My wife is also biracial. Her grandfather immigrated from China to Mexico, so she's Chinese Mexican. My mother-in-law is literally looks Asian. But she was born in Mexico, raised in Mexico. So my wife has Asian features. A lot of her family have Asian features. So she's mixed. So you get my kids together, and you've got black, white, Chinese, and Mexican all together. The question of questions of race and ethnicity and which race is better than the other are discussions we just really cannot have in our household, and they seem so silly and petty and ridiculous, quite honestly.
Right.
And so. Right. He's come around. He's around my kids, and so he sees all of that. He loves them, and I think it's kind of softened him over time.
Right. Well, let me back up, because I guess I'm just picking up on a few interesting points here. I mean, here's your grandmother, who is staunch Mormon, you know, goes way back, yet she herself does something a little bit rebellious in marrying a non-Mormon.
And she and her mother was a Hancock. My great grandmother's maiden name was Hancock, and she's born up there. I don't know this history. My grandmother has since passed away. I don't know why.
Do you know if she received any grief about
marrying outside
your grandfather?
The fold?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't. Probably she never talked about it. Hmm. So I don't know. I don't know kind of what went on there. But he was. I mean, he was a white man, so that probably was a little better than my mother's situation.
What was it like for your grandfather to come and kind of offer this apology and yet pretty much still tell you that he's a racist and can't be seen with you? What was that like for you?
For me, I'm just generally not a judgmental person. What I saw is, this is a 70-year-old man, that this was a very courageous act on his part to take this step and reach out to me at this point. We had never met. My mom had never really talked about him. He had not been around us as kids. He had missed out on our whole childhood. I wanted to give him a chance to overcome this, because I recognized that he was the one that was in the wrong. And it wasn't going to help the situation for me to point a finger or judge him. But to allow him he wanted to come forward. He wanted. I knew that he was the one that was going to benefit from seeing that I'm not a creature. We're not creatures. We are human beings just like you. And the interesting thing, because my mom wasn't married, wasn't married to my father when I was born. My last name is his last name, because I've got Jones. Jones is her dad's name. I literally, my mom was his only child, and then she wasn't married when she had me. So I have the last name Jones. I'm his only namesake descendant. And so I've got a son as well that has the name Jones. And so I think he senses the connection there, and he's just kind of overcome it. He since has met with us, and we've met with his siblings. I actually have met his which would be my great uncles. I've met them. He's introduced us into his family that's here. He's told them, "Yeah, this is my daughter's kids." It was kind of interesting going to meet with these, you know, octogenarians, kind of at like an old restaurant, an Applebee's or something we went to for Sunday brunch. But just
For so many people, it's so important to carry on the name, right? And here he's faced with this conundrum that he has the opportunity to have his name carried on, and yet not in the way he had maybe expected or hoped for.
Yeah, and because I didn't know him, and I just knew that he had essentially disowned my mom because of the race issue, I still didn't harbor any hard feelings, because I just recognized and acknowledged he was a product of his time. That was just how they thought, and he never had done anything to me to harm me. And I just felt always that he was the one that was missing out. So when he reached out, I reached out to him as well, embraced him, and brought him into our family, and I did as I think any member of the church would should do or would want to do, and that's just to be Christ-like about it.
And
we had his 75th birthday party at my house, and my kids celebrated him, and they call him Grandpa Jones. And so I think it has really helped to just break down those walls, just him being exposed. But he was very open in admitting early on that he struggled for years and years and years with it. Because another part of that I haven't shared with you is that my mother, after having me and moving to Arizona, she met my stepfather, who was also black. And so she ultimately married him, but prior to them being married, they lived out of wedlock and had a couple more kids. And so there was this pattern of my mom and her relationship and having kids with black men.
Yeah, she had children with three black men.
There's three different black men, absolutely. Okay. Yes. And so she lived with my stepfather in this for a number of years, and ultimately, and I don't know all the circumstances of how this transpired, but I know that prior to 1978, the revelation, she was actually excommunicated for these acts, which
for living always, with your stepfather, you mean?
Living with my stepfather and having kids, and they were not married. I don't know what the practice was back in the 70s with respect to a quote-unquote single sister that's living with a man and maybe have had kids or whatever. They had kind of a common law type of marriage arrangement where they were living together. They were obviously committed, had 2 or 3 kids, but they hadn't married. And she was excommunicated. I've always wondered if there was an element of race involved, if it was the black thing. This was prior to 78. I know that
meaning if she had been living with a white man and having children, was she active or inactive at this
point? She'd been completely inactive. Inactive. She'd been
so
inactive.
So they kind of went out of their way to excommunicate her.
Yeah, because this wasn't her home ward. It wasn't she grew up in Winslow. She moved to Phoenix. She was here. My grandmother, in her attempts to keep my mom in contact with the church, would make sure that wherever she lived, the ward knew where she was. But I know that the ward that she was excommunicated from was not – I mean, it wasn't like she had been going there as an active member and all of a sudden fell away and did some things that were bad. And so then she was brought into a church disciplinary council. That wasn't the case. I think it was more of wherever she was living, and they knew what she was doing. She was living in sin with this man, and she wasn't married, and she had kids. And
wow.
And so I think that's kind of more how it transpired. And so we ultimately didn't get baptized until I got baptized when I was 13, because my stepfather, who kind of saw all of this stuff happening, struggled with the church, struggled with the blacks issue and the priesthood issue and kind of some things related to church doctrine. And so he wouldn't allow us to get baptized, me and my younger siblings that were his direct kids.
Right. And he was, I guess, taking the discussions or what?
He took the discussions a number of times up until the mid-80s when I ultimately got baptized. I got baptized in 86. I was in 8th grade at the time. Got baptized in 86.
And were you guys going to church by this point, or?
Yeah, by the time I was 8 years old, we had moved into a ward where, and we kind of had set down roots, and we started going to church quite a bit. I got involved in the Cub Scout program, and so I was in Cub Scouts and Weebelows. So essentially, was living the Mormon experience growing up in the church. I got to the age of getting the priesthood and at 12, and I wasn't allowed to get the priesthood because I wasn't baptized, but I'd go to church. I was able to hang out with the deacons and all of that at 12. And ultimately, by the time I was 13, and my stepfather had gotten baptized or was getting baptized was more serious about the church.
Oh, so he finally joined as well.
Yeah, he finally joined, and then allowed us to get. I think we got baptized within the same year that he got baptized, but he wanted to go first, and so he got baptized first, and then he allowed me to get baptized, and I think my younger brother, who was already of age, to get baptized as well. And then after, about a year or so after he and then us kids got baptized, my mom actually got rebaptized.
Oh, wow.
Right afterwards as well. So it was a good time, kind of late 80s, where the family was kind of was essentially becoming full members of the church in that sense. But from the time I was 8 years old.
Yeah, so when you were eight, was that just you going by yourself, or your mother was taking you, or like
my mother would take us. The primary leaders would come by. Like I said, whenever we moved, my grandmother would make sure that the ward knew where we were. Even though my mother was an excommunicated member at this point, they still would reach out to us. They would still come by. I still had all these great leaders that would come by and take us to scouting activities and things like that. So we just definitely benefited from the arm of fellowship of the membership coming out and helping us out and being members of the church. I mean, I wasn't baptized, but I can't tell you just because I wasn't baptized until I was 13 that I felt that I wasn't a member of the church. I've always been a member of the church. I was blessed as a baby, and don't ever recollect not, you know, knowing primary songs. I remember singing primary songs. I'm a Child of God at 3 and 4 years old in primary. I just had the memories of being, and again, my grandmother just making sure that we always felt like the church was ours.
And with you, I know you've been in some leadership positions yourself. You haven't come across this idea that women get excommunicated because they're, or especially inactive women who are not coming to church get excommunicated because they're living with somebody. Is that, do you see that as very?
Yeah, I served in a bishopric. I was a counselor in a bishopric, and I've served on the high council, been through kind of church disciplinary administration of these types of things. I've read the handbook. I can't see where it would happen, quite honestly, particularly there've got to be, I mean, thousands of women that have fallen away from the church in their teens that are not married now, that are living in the same circumstances, and I can't imagine that we're not calling them all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I don't know if it was, maybe it was a different time back in the 70s that this was going on. Again, I wonder if the element of race was there. I know that, I mean, when you look at what was written, what was said by McConkie and others at the time, to mix the races with the black person was not taken lightly. I mean, there was a lot that was said about it. There was my grandmother talked to me around the time I was going on my mission, and even after I came back, there was a lot of emotion in her that she really, really sensed. I mean, this book that she gave me that talks about these doctrines has all these quotes and has an annotated bibliography in the back of it. It's just this prophet and all the just quotes. I mean, it's just a list of quotes and the dates and the reference. I mean, it's just.
Can I give you two of those as far as what maybe?
Maybe we're probably in this book.
Yeah, I don't know if they were in that book, but I'm sure played a part in why your grandmother was having such a difficult time. This is Brigham Young. Says, if the white man who belongs to the chosen seed mixes his blood with the seed of Cain, the penalty under the law of God is death on the spot. This will always be so. That was in the Journal of Discourses. And then Wilford Woodruff, who says, and if any man mingle his seed with the seed of Cain, the only way he could get rid of it or have salvation would be to come forward and have his head cut off and spill his blood upon the ground. It would also take the life of his children.
Wow. I can just imagine how my grandmother was feeling as she's, her daughter, who's a descendant of the pioneers, has chosen to leave the church and marry or have a child and mix the races with a black person. I mean, you read that quote, it doesn't give a whole lot of wiggle room for relief. I can only imagine how she was feeling.
Yeah, it's pretty pretty severe language as far as what was put forth. You know, at some point. And I guess, you know, similarly to maybe with your grandfather, I don't know how much of this you can say, well, it was a product of the time. However, to my knowledge, these types of quotes have never been recounted specifically or, you know, in some type of formal fashion. And so I can see how somebody like your grandmother would still believe that this is very much part of our doctrine.
Well, this was prior to 1978, so there was not even any revelation extending the priesthood. So this, in her mind, all of these teachings, and we can get into specifics at some point about them, but all of these teachings at the time that I was born were real. These were teachings given by the prophets, seers, and revelators of the church, and you believed them. You accepted them. You had many elders. The quotes that you gave go back over 100 years, but there were many, many things that were said in the 1940s and the 50s. There are official First Presidency statements that reaffirm these positions as the church was starting to get a little bit of heat from the civil rights movement and from different social changes about blacks and priesthood and treatment of blacks. The church was feeling some things, and so there was a need to issue statements. So there were some First Presidency official statements issued explaining the church's position, and essentially just reiterating it was the Lord's decision, and that's it. The Lord will change these things when the Lord wants to change these things, but just kind of digging in the heels. But there were a lot of explanations given by leaders of the church, apostles, explaining these types of things that kind of now in hindsight, as I looked at some of these quotes and I talked to some members of the church about them now, they dismissed them as, you know, that was their opinion. That was just their opinion. That was their personal opinion. That wasn't church doctrine. And I always find that very puzzling because I don't hear that as much in our current time. You know, if Elder Packard gives a talk in general conference, we don't just walk out and say, that's his personal opinion. it's a true believing member of the church believes that this is an apostle who's a prophet, seer, and revelator, and speaks for the Lord. And I know that my grandmother, when she's reading these quotes and reading these teachings by Joseph Fielding Smith, reading these teachings by Bruce R. McConkie, again, prior to 1978, this was the explanation of the things as they are, not just speculation as personal opinion. This was truth. This was belief.
I have another quote. I can't help this. I'm sorry. says Brigham Young again. If there is an elder here or any member of this church called the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints who can bring up the first idea, the first sentence that I have delivered to the people as counsel that is wrong, I really wish they would do it, but they cannot do it for the simple reason that I have never given counsel that is wrong. This is the reason.
Right. Well, you're the prophet and you never give counsel that's wrong. I mean, who's to question? If you're a faithful, believing member of the church, you're not going to. And that was essentially from my childhood experience and again, my grandmother's desire to teach me truth, and my mom's desire to teach me truth. These statements and these quotes by these leaders were taught to me as absolute truths. As difficult as they were for me to understand, as difficult as they were for me to believe, they were taught as absolute truths. I mean, I again being very very inquisitive even at a young age, I had my own copy, my own personal copy of Mormon Doctrine by Bruce R. McConkie. And when you read through there, I mean, he doesn't mince words either about many of these things in terms of explaining who the quote-unquote the Negroes are and where they come from. And I don't know if you want to talk about some of these things. We're kind of touching on some of the doctrinal things that my grandmother obviously was very much aware of in terms of my background, but and it also was passed on to me.
Yeah, I definitely want to go there next, but before you do that, you know, you bring up Bruce R. McConkie, and I know that probably if anybody ever said anything after the priesthood ban was lifted, I believe it was Bruce R. McConkie who said something to the effect of, you know, just ignore everything that has been said before. We were not working with, you know, the proper light and knowledge.
Limited light. We had limited light.
Right. And, you know, and if so, what do you make of that? I mean, was that the statement that the church made officially? Or, like, was that, what was that?
Well, it's definitely not the official statement because, again, it's quote unquote just by Bruce R. McConkie. But I think he was so vocal in his explanations about race, about segregation, about Cain, about the descendants of Cain, the mark of Cain, I mean, you look at his writings, he was probably the one who spoke about these the most. And so when the revelation was announced in 1978, he had to say something. And so I think the appropriate thing for him to say was, we spoke with limited light. And I believe that's a correct statement. I think he did speak with limited light, and I think that was his acknowledgement.
But it was almost a personal acknowledgement. It wasn't an acknowledgement that was an official statement by the church.
Even more than that, I mean, when you say, you know, everything that was said prior to this, to disregard, I'm paraphrasing him, he wasn't speaking to, and I've looked at that talk, he wasn't speaking to the specific principles of who blacks are. I when I read his statement about we spoke with limited light, all that was with respect to, were the blacks going to get the priesthood? Brigham Young was saying they weren't going to get the priesthood till the millennium. Many others had said they wouldn't get the priesthood till the millennium. Well, they got the priesthood, and it happened in 1978. So when he gives his talk later on saying, well, we spoke with limited light, because obviously they've got the priesthood, that's separate and apart from the other doctrinal things, the other teachings, the other statements with respect to Cain, the curse, and all these other things that are separate and apart from the statements that leaders had given that they would never get the priesthood. So again, I read that, to me, when I read McConkie's statement about limited light, is it had been said by many that the blacks would not get the priesthood. Well, they got the priesthood, and so they spoke with limited light. But there's still these other tenets, these other doctrinal, these other teachings, these other principles that had been laid out and elaborated and discussed. They're all still there. That's all still there. Right. And I don't believe that his statement swept all that away, because right. And evidence of that is Mormon doctrine itself, the book Mormon Doctrine, where all this is in here, they explain this. I mean, it was in print, and you could buy it at Deseret Book until May of last year.
Correct.
I mean, they just stopped selling it. So my kid, anyone's kid, could go into the store and you pick up Mormon Doctrine. I mean, unless you're really sophisticated and nuanced with your gospel study, when you pick up a book that says Mormon Doctrine, you believe this is Mormon doctrine.
Well, especially written by, an apostle, prominent leader in our church.
Yeah, and so there's been
no denouncement from the church saying this is not correct Mormon doctrine.
Right. I mean, there's some comments, I believe, at the beginning. There's a disclaimer of sorts at the beginning of Mormon doctrine. But again, most members of the church, I remember even being, when I served my mission in New York City, members there in Harlem, in the Bronx, Brooklyn, they knew Mormon doctrine and they knew this book. And this is what people referenced as the doctrine. It's essentially, it was the first compendium. It was the first encyclopedia of our Mormon theology in the modern era. So you go through there and look up a topic and look at the cross references, and you got the explanation. So the fact that this would still be in print, sold at a church-owned bookstore,
right,
sends the message.
Strong message, yes.
Because even in here, I mean, the copy I have was updated in 1978. It has the reference to the 1978 revelation. So this isn't an old one. This was updated in 1978 to acknowledge that the blacks got the priesthood. But the funny thing, Natasha, again, under the priesthood section, it makes the acknowledgement, hey, we got a revelation, 1978, blacks got the priesthood. And it still has all the cross references, but look at Cain, look at the preexistence, look at Sons of Perdition. It still has all of that in there. So again, when I look at Bruce R. McConkie's statement, it's only with respect to this section of his own book that talks about the priesthood not going to blacks, and then, hey, we got a revelation 1978. Everything we said about that is gone. All of the other sections in the book are still there. None of the other sections got edited that much, from what I understand.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
So going back to your family and your grandmother specifically, because that's why we got off on the tangent, I guess, of why your grandmother would feel the way she did. Can you expound a little bit for me on your relationship with her? I mean, you're telling me that she was a huge influence in your life, a huge influence as to your membership in the church and even your feeling, you know, this kind of heritage with the church. Did you guys ever have a chance to kind of sit down, and you kind of, I guess, made reference to that as far as having some more in-depth conversations about her feelings towards you and how she came to terms with these things? I mean, at some point she's showing you off at a family reunion, so mm-hmm. she obviously came to some
Yeah, I believe that for her, she was, in my mind, one that studied the doctrines, studied things, studied these books. That's why she had these books, The Church and the Negro. She had these different statements. She wanted to understand what the implication of her posterity was, and them being black. I believe that once 1978 and the revelation on the priesthood was given, I think that changed everything in her mind in terms of she really just focused on us being descendants of the Mormon pioneers, and we have a special mission in the church to open people's eyes to the gospel. She always talked to us about the fact that, you know, there will be people that will listen to you all about the gospel that will not listen to somebody else just because of your color of your skin. You will be able to open doors that others weren't. And so I always felt like, okay, maybe that's the reason why I was born part black. Because for me, when you read the statement, read some of these statements and some of the doctrinal explanations about the pre-existence that was there, I had a hard time reconciling what I felt. I always felt that I was a good person. It's just more my nature. Wish no harm on anyone. It was kind of inconceivable, some of these other teachings about my dark skin being because of acts in the pre-existence, things that I had done in the pre-existence. So my grandmother really instilled in us that sense of pride and of purpose within the church, and being here to show a different face, to show that all are alike unto God, and that this is the Lord's church, this is His kingdom, and He is no respecter of persons. She for her 1978 and everything that changed everything, and we never really talked about it.
Okay.
And I never ever sensed any type of racial issues or anything like that from her. She was definitely was very, very proud of her grandkids, very proud.
And did she ever, I guess, try to explain to you how she felt at the beginning, like prior to 78, or?
Well, before my mission, she did have a heart to heart with me where she wept and almost it was that sense of apologizing for what she did feel about the sense of despair that this Mormon pioneer heritage was somehow mixing with the black race, and that she didn't know what that meant. Based on all the things that had been said, some of the quotes that you read, she struggled with that, but she didn't get into trying. Well, she did. I mean, she talked to me about. I remember her talking to me about some of the doctrinal things that the pre-existence, and that our race, just right out of Mormon doctrine, it's there too, that our race is determined based on our agency and how we exercised our agency in the pre-existence. That was taught by Bruce R. McConkie. It was taught by others before him, that your race was dictated by your pre-existent acts. She talked about, and she was just quoting from leaders of the church, you know, the mark of Cain. I remember her talking to me about Cain and how Cain's posterity was preserved through Ham, through Egyptus. I mean, this is right out of Pearl of Great Price. This is right out of the Book of Abraham. And she'd quote that, and you could look at that, and that's just what it was. And Cain sinned, and he had the mark of Cain. It was the dark skin. It was passed on to Ham so that it would come after the flood. Ham was Noah's son. His wife was Egyptus, and then he's essentially the father of the black race, and that race was marked with a curse and was never to get the priesthood. And that's essentially our Mormon theology. That's what with respect to black race, it's in all these books, and that's never been taken back. So my grandmother talked about that. I remember hearing about, she was kind of funny because now we kind of chuckle about it, but the whole lore of Bigfoot, I remember, I don't know if you've ever heard these stories, but I remember hearing these things as a kid about Bigfoot being Cain, because Cain was marked and he would never die, and he'd walk and roam the earth forever.
Yes, I've heard that myth. Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a Mormon folklore now, mm-hmm. But as a 10-year-old little boy and hearing these things, and this was gospel doctrine. I remember being a kid going and checking out all the Bigfoot books at my elementary school, because I just had this. I want to understand what Bigfoot was like and everything, because, I mean, we chuckle about it, but there are references to it. Spencer W. Kimball references this notion this lore, he teaches it not as lore, it's taught as though, yeah, that Cain was roaming the earth, and he, in the book, The Miracle of Forgiveness, there is a reference to this story, again, being perpetuated by apostle and a modern prophet, that Cain was roaming the earth, and he appeared to this man, and he was hairy, and this and that, and so very believable to me. I mean, Spencer W. Kimball was the prophet when I was a kid, and he was talking about Cain being essentially being Bigfoot, and so you grew up with that. I mean, I just thought it was real. It was rather strange. I know by the time I got to mission age, I was kind of questioning and wondering, how can this be true? I mean, is my skin color really a mark from Cain? And how do we know that I'm a descendant of Cain? How come it's not somebody else? And I used to always wonder, you know, how do we know it's not the Polynesians? The Polynesians are darker than I am. I mean, some of the Polynesians are darker than we. So why are they not dark? Why isn't the curse them? Or people from India? I've met people from India. There are a lot of people from India and Indians that are darker. I mean, how do we know that's not the mark of Cain? So I was always looking at different ethnicities, trying to determine why my race, that the African Negro race, was the one that was considered the mark of Cain. Again, it's lore. It's out there. It's been around. It's not something that's unique just to Mormonism. It's kind of a folklore that has existed. I mean, it was used to justify slavery centuries ago, but it's been around for a long time. And I think what happened was Mormonism, kind of Joseph Smith, it somehow made its way into the Book of Abraham, this thinking, and we made the connection from Ham to Cain. Originally, it was just most churches talked about descendants of Ham being black, being Africans, and Joseph Smith and the Pearl Great Price, Book of Abraham, makes the connection from Ham up to Cain. So you get that whole Canaanite lineage thing. Right. So all that was kind of weighing. My mom, my grandmother talked to me about those types of things. I know in her heart of hearts she wasn't trying to instill teachings that were going to be disturbing. It was just, this is the way it was. I mean, it is what it is. And she can't explain it. The brethren have never explained it, even to this day. She obviously was in no position to explain or denounce something that one of the apostles had said.
Right.
And we're not talking just about Brigham Young or some of the others, John Taylor, going way back. We're talking even her lifetime. These were leaders that she would listen to at conference. These were leaders that she would read in her books. They were contemporaries for her.
Absolutely, right.
So it wasn't stretching back 100 years and being able to kind of dismiss them as they were a product of their time. Brigham Young was different. This was President McKay, this was McConkie, this was Joseph Fielding Smith. These were her contemporary leaders of her church, and this is how they explained it. She had nothing else to teach me but this.
But well, what's so interesting...
In that same vein, she wanted to make sure that I knew that I was chosen because I was pioneer stock, that I had the white blood too, so there was something, I had something else in me too.
Yeah, I guess that's the point I was going to make. It's so interesting, you know, when I think of myself as a parent and trying to teach my children, you know, kind of their divine worth and high self-esteem and that they can trust themselves and, you know, they're good, you know, those messages that we want to give to our kids. And, you know, here's your grandmother in a position where she loves you and is, you know, obviously dedicated to you. And on the one hand, she's instilling this pride, and on the other hand, she's instilling this shame, you know, with things that she's trying to make sense of herself. It's so hard for me to wrap my brain around what that would be like for her, you know, from an intellectual kind of position, and also from you receiving that at such a young age. I mean, I can't imagine at your developmental stages as a child that you would know how to even integrate that to even know how that was affecting you. And that maybe now as an adult, you're maybe just getting kind of an insight or a clue as to how these types of messages infiltrated your life and affected your sense of self.
As an adult, I can say that I remember being a young kid, even before I was in adolescence, and struggling with some of these teachings, because I remember looking at some of these things early on, even before I was 13, even before I got baptized, just because I knew that the question of race was an issue my stepfather was dealing with. I remember looking at some of these things, and you read the statement, something this says, the Lord placed on Cain a mark of dark skin, and he became the ancestor of the black race. And a statement like that from a leader who's a leader of your church, is an apostle, and you're looking at the church as direction and wisdom, and you're looking at these as they're inspired. You can't make sense of it, but you wonder how this can be. And I think as faithful members of the church, on this issue of race, and I've had members talk to me about this even recently, it's just one of those things you say, well, you just have to have faith. And so we believe you just have faith, and you just kind of set it aside and don't let it fester, because you don't want it to destroy your faith or destroy your testimony. But you experience that cognitive dissonance where it just doesn't seem to make sense. And I know for me, statements like that, or statements that being taught that my race, that I had done something, that pre-existent thing was really was the biggest burden, probably even more than the dark skin side of thing. The notion that somehow I did something in a previous life
that
I have no recollection of, but I somehow exercised my agency in the pre-existence in a way that determined that I would be born through a black race and not get the priesthood, or even my ancestors. It was they were in the same situation. I have no recollection of it. It created in me kind of this sense of a desire to prove myself, that I needed to somehow. It was almost like penitence, a penance. I needed to somehow overcome or show or prove to Heavenly Father, prove to the Lord that I wanted to keep my second estate, as I was taught. I mean that you kept your first estate by being faithful in the pre-existence and being born was your first estate, and part of these teachings that McConkie, Joseph Fielding Smith, and others had was that blacks were fence sitters. And I remember that term as a kid, that being taught. In reading some of these quotes, that somehow in the pre-existence I was a fence sitter, which meant that I didn't know whether I was supposed to follow Jesus or follow Lucifer, that I was on the fence. And you can research that term. It's out there. It exists.
Yeah.
The concept of a fence sitter. And so I was ambivalent somehow in whether I would follow Jesus Christ or not. And I remember struggling with that at 10, 11, 12 years old, because it just didn't seem right. Because from the time that I was going to church, I loved the church. All I wanted to do was be at church as a kid. From the time I was 8 years old and going more actively, I was in love with the church. The church was my world. So it was just so incomprehensible to think that in my previous life, I didn't like Jesus. I didn't want to follow Jesus. Are you kidding? That's all I want to do. I mean, all I want to do now. Why wouldn't I have done that? And the notion that my spirit was the same spirit that I had in the pre-existent, is just now, I just now have a mortal body. It didn't make sense, but it instilled in me this desire, this need to somehow attain or achieve my second estate. And so I just want to make sure I lived with exactness. I was going to do everything. I was going to go on my mission. I'm paying my tithing. I remember being a little kid, and we didn't have a lot of money growing up. But I remember hoarding. I remember, I get a little emotional about this, but I remember wanting to live the teaching so much that I would hoard cans of food. I would hoard cans of food under my bed because I wanted to make sure we had a year's supply. I wanted to make sure that we were following the counsel of the brethren to have that year's supply of food in case something happened. So I remember stacking these cans of food under my bed, my mom not even knowing about it, because I was going to be prepared, and I would put these little containers of water and things like that.
Wow.
So I just got this sense of it didn't seem comprehensible that I was not valiant in the pre-existence, and that was what dictated the skin color. But it also instilled in me this desire to really prove that I can live with exactness. And so I just started making very, very definitive choices, black and white. The church is true. The world is false. The God, I need to live this way. I need to do that. I mean, it was right and wrong. And I was one of those that didn't have a caffeinated drink literally until I was, I think I was on my mission, towards the end of my mission, only because some of the other elders had drank Coke, and I was like, you're drinking Coke? I remember being in the MTC and meeting missionaries that had Coke and Dr. Pepper. And I was thinking, oh my goodness, how can you do that? Heavenly Father's going to strike you down. But my thinking was so orthodox in the sense that I need to show Heavenly Father that I don't know what I did in the preexistence, but I'm going to overcome this in this life, and I'm going to live with exactness, and I'm going to show and prove, and I'm going to serve in every calling, and I'm going to pay a 10% tithe, 100% tithing. I'm going to do my fast offering. I'm going to serve my mission. I'm going to go on a mission, come back, get married in the temple. I'm going to do everything that the Lord wants me to do so that I can overcome that whatever I did in the preexistence. And, wow. and it may sound comical now, but it's what I thought. It's what I felt.
I don't know that it sounds comical. I mean, it's to me, I just, you know, I have this image of you right now as this young kind of just, you know, light in your eyes kind of kid and just wanting to please and do what's good, and so much mental energy being spent on trying to fix something that you don't even know how you did wrong. And it just goes against so many of our other doctrines. I mean, the second article of faith, it says we are not going to be punished for something that happened before us. We're going to just be, you know, accountable for our own mistakes and sins. And and when it comes to the preexistence, I mean, most of us, at least the white part of us, you know, we get these great affirmative type statements like, well, there was like a pre-calling, right? You were called before this time.
Foreordained.
Right. You were foreordained, and it kind of makes you feel special. And it makes you feel like, wow, I must have done something right to be born into a family that has the gospel or to be in this position. We kind of have those messages that feed our self-esteem.
Chosen generation, you're Israel, you're the cream of the crop. You were saved. Of Israel, you were saved for the last days.
Right. Yeah. And here you're in the same church getting very harmful messages for your self-esteem. And I just find it very a tragedy, traumatically sad.
Well, I remember struggling with some of these issues prior to receiving my patriarchal blessing. And I've got this desire because I love the church. I love the gospel. I wanted to do everything that was church related. I can tell you that from the time I was baptized at 13, I never missed a Sunday. I did not miss a Sunday sacramenting church. Probably, I think it was after my mission. I was married. I remember, I mean, I could, and I think for some reason we couldn't go to church, and it was just like the end of the world. Wow. This is probably maybe 10, 12 years ago. It was my first time missing a church meeting because of that desire to live with exactness. And so from the time I was going to church actively and was baptized, I took it very, very seriously, and I took the statements of the leaders very, very seriously because I took them as gospel truths. They were absolute truths. I did not understand them, but they were the truths. Who was I to question the Lord when the leaders themselves who were making these statements and explanations were saying, we don't know. It was the Lord's will. This is what it was. I remember going and getting my patriarchal blessing, and I knew enough about patriarchal blessings to know that you go get a patriarchal blessing because you want to know your lineage. You want to know what the Lord, you want to know about that the patriarch speaks for Heavenly Father, that he's opening up, he puts his hands on your head, and he talks to you, and he tells you about your preexistence. And he can't talk about the preexistence, and he can talk about your life here, and he can talk about things that are going to happen to you in this life, what blessings you got. And so I was very attuned to anything that would reference the preexistent life and things like that. And unfortunately, there are some statements in my patriarchal blessing that say that I was one of Heavenly Father's children that accepted the plan advocated by our elder brother Jesus Christ, wherein we were to come to this earth and be given experiences and through free agency prove ourselves worthy. You supported this plan and were promised great blessings if you were true and faithful to the covenants you made. That statement right there at the very beginning of my patriarchal blessing gave me great comfort, because to me that's telling me that I wasn't a fence sitter. It's telling me that I championed and supported the plan of Jesus Christ in the preexistence. And that was important to me. I remember feeling very emotional about that was the truth. Because I had struggled with it. I got my patriarchal blessing, you got baptized and you could get your patriarchal blessing within, you had to wait a year before you could get it. I got it a year after I got baptized.
Oh, wow. So you got it like when you were 14.
I was 14 years old. I wanted that patriarchal blessing because these issues of race, the preexistence, the doctrines, Cain, all these different things, even at 14 years old, were weighing on my mind. I was thinking about these things.
Wow.
I've always been kind of a thinker and an analytical person, and I was thinking about them. When it came, and so that statement's in the patriarchal blessing. When it came down to the question of lineage, I wanted to know my lineage, and I had everyone I knew that had got a patriarchal blessing knew their lineage, and I wanted to know that great blessing that came to me. When that portion of the blessing came, it was different, and it references that I would receive all the blessings of Israel, and I will receive all the blessings promised to the ancient patriarchs Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And that these blessings are yours by reason of adoption into the house of Israel. And that's it. No Ephraim.
Hmm.
No statement that says you are of the tribe of Ephraim. You are of the tribe of Manasseh. No Reuben. No one. No one else. And that was the end of the blessing. And I thought, okay, well, what does that mean? And I read it. And I got the official written copy of it. So I remember talking to leaders about my patriarchal blessing and the omission of any specific tribe, any lineage. It references that I'm adopted into the house of Israel, and I didn't know what that meant for a while, obviously, but I was curious about it. I remember asking my seminary teacher about it. Because I attended that religiously, I was not going to miss any seminary. I mean, my freshman year of high school, when I got this blessing, was the Book of Mormon year, and I just loved it, got into the Book of Mormon, had a great experience in loving seminary and wanting to learn everything I could. And not in specific reference to a question that I posed to my seminary teacher, but I remember distinctly a lesson we had in the class. This was before I got the patriarchal blessing, if you can imagine this. Before I got the patriarchal blessing, I remember sitting in the class and we were talking about lineage in seminary. And I remember the seminary teacher putting on the board, he had this little this vertical scale, and he was talking about kind of what you were saying, Natasha, about, you know, the elect of God being Israel. And he said, you know, he put them at the cream of the crop, the Israel, and then he had Gentiles, and then he had Canaanites. And he had these three groups. These were the three groups I remember him putting on the board. He had Israel. It was kind of like a bar chart. And so Israel was kind of small, and then Gentile was a little larger, and then Canaanites were a little larger. And he had these three groups of people there. And I think he was talking about it in the context of the gospel going throughout the world, and Israel getting it first, and then it going to the Gentiles, and then to the Canaanites, descendants of Cain in 1978. But I remember him talking about these three groups, and talking about Israel being chosen, and we being the class as a whole, collectively being of Israel, and being the chosen of the chosen. And I remember sitting, this is before I got my patriarchal blessing, sitting kind of looking at the Cain thing at the bottom, that tier, that lowest tier of Heavenly Father's children, and still having and struggling with that in my mind after having read all these things, and wondering, what in the world did I do? Existence. What did I do? And I struggled with that because it just didn't make any sense to me, if you can imagine, because it was incomprehensible. Mm-hmm. But again, it was what it was. These were the groups, and I was clearly descended of Cain. So I get my patriarchal blessing. I remember asking him about.
Did he say anything that you were the descendant of Cain? Like, or you just already knew this doctrine,
I knew the doctrine. He was giving an explanation of just of ethnicity. Probably we were covering something in the Book of Mormon about the Gentiles and the gospel going forth to Gentiles and going throughout the world. And it's probably his attempt to just kind of explain. Again, this is what was on the books. This was I was in high school in the late 80s. This was only 10 years after the priesthood. All the books and all the statements they were still in print. They were still in circulation. I'm sure he was taught these things himself. And when he was in high school, I know he graduated high school in the 70s, late 70s. So I'm being educated by people that grew up under these teachings as well.
Right.
And
right.
So I can't necessarily fault them for using the resources from the brethren. How would anyone say that these were not approved teachings if they were coming from the brethren? So it's his way of explaining race and ethnicity and things like that at the time. And so, but I remember talking to him after I got my patriarchal blessing about the lineage issue and my blessing not referencing any specific lineage, not of one of the tribes, and what does that mean? And the comfort I got was, yes, the statement says that you're by reason of adoption, you will receive all the blessings by reason of adoption into the house of Israel. So there, clearly, the blessing is affirming and confirming that I'm not blood wise, I'm not of Israel, right? I mean, is there any other way to interpret that?
Right.
That my lineage, I'm not of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, again, lineage, I think nowadays we talk about lineage from a more spiritual side of things.
But, and I think even then, I mean, the lineage thing of Israel, I mean, that would be anybody who's not a Jew, correct? So, I mean, that was a lot of us. It wasn't just.
But I think there were a lot of statements by a lot of leaders that talked about the blood of Israel making its way to the Americas. I believe that Joseph Smith is a direct descendant of Israel through. I mean, there's references to that, statements about that. I believe some of the other leaders. I mean, there was all.
I just wonder about the Gentiles. You know, like even back in the days of Jesus, and I'm not sure that the Gentiles were considered.
Of Israel, they weren't of Israel,
right?
Yeah, they weren't the lineage of Israel, and so yeah, that would be a lot of other people. So the reference in my patriarchal blessing to say that I was adopted in the house of Israel, it was different than everyone else I knew.
Just like the rest of us were adopted, but we were adopted into a specific tribe, and you for some reason weren't. That's confusing to me.
But your blessing, and I've never met anyone else whose blessing says you're adopted into the house of Israel to the tribe of Ephraim.
Yeah,
it just says you're of Israel and you're of Ephraim.
Right.
That was it. Mine specifically called out and said you're adopted in the house of Israel. So I wasn't.
Right.
And probably because of my family history a little bit, I'm probably understanding and thinking about, okay, adoption means you're not of something, so you're adopted into. So you're kind of grafted in, grandfathered in, brought into. A situation. So, again,
right, looking at my own experience, because I don't come from, you know, obviously pioneer heritage. So when I would ask those questions, like how do they know that I'm of the line of anything? They would just explain it in the terms of, well, whether or not you are or not by blood, you've been adopted into it. So maybe that's why I'm confusing the actual verbiage in my blessing versus what I was told, you know, as how to interpret it.
Right.
But I think that your verbiage was actually different.
Yeah, mine clearly says you are adopted into the house of Israel.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Different than others of my mission companions and friends who were of Israel, of the tribe of Ephraim, of Israel, of the tribe of Manasseh, or of Judah. A very, very clearly declaration that they are of Israel. My blessing says I'm not of Israel, but I'm entitled to that I will receive the blessings, kind of a future statement. I will receive the blessings of Israel by reason of my adoption into the house of Israel.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. 'Tis better far for us to strive our useless cares from us to drive, to this end joy your hearts will swell. Oh, all is well, all is well. Should we mourn? journeys through.